Deutsche Welle. Africa Link.
Welcome to DW's Africa Link program, coming to you live from our studios in Bonn, Germany. I'm Isaac Mugabe.
And I'm Jane Ayeka Kumed. Remember, Africa Link is also live on Facebook, so do join the conversation.
That's right, indeed. In today's program, Boko Haram leader Abubakar Shekau has claimed responsibility for attacks in Nigeria's northwestern regions during the festive season. We hear from a frustrated local resident.
The military has to do a thorough reorganization of their military officers so that there is no part X among them who used to sell the arms and ammunition to the oppositions.
And we've been finding out the challenges that await Liberia's new president, George Weah.
George Weah's challenge ahead of him will be people that are not creative in society, who would try to infiltrate through friendship or other means to depreciate his government.
Well, these are some of the stories we've lined up for you.
But first, here is a chance to listen to what's been happening around the world.
My name is Jane Nyinge with DW News. In a surprise move, the Ethiopian government has ordered the release of all its political prisoners and the closure of a notorious detention center. The office of the prime minister has also announced that charges against politicians facing trial will be dropped. The move is designed to allow political dialogue after human rights groups accused the government of using mass arrests and detention to silence the opposition. Tasfalem Waldes of DW's Amharic service was once detained by the Ethiopian government. He describes what the news means to him.
As a former prisoner of Makalawi Detention Center, this is a big news for me. Makalawi is a horrible place even to spend a night. A lot of human rights abuses are executed there. I was advocating for the closure of this detention center and converted to a museum. And that is what the Prime Minister promised today. Whether he keep his promise or not, it remains to be seen. But the decision is a dream comes true.
11 people have been killed in a suicide attack on a mosque in Borno State, northeastern Nigeria. According to security forces, the suicide bomber is among those who died during the attack, which has been blamed on Boko Haram militants. In recent months, Boko Haram have stepped up the attacks on military and civilian targets, despite government's claims of wiping them out. Turning to the Middle East, Palestinians have said they will not succumb to blackmail after U.S. President Donald Trump threatened to withhold future aid over what he termed the Palestinians' unwillingness to enter into peace talks with Israel. Palestinian anger at Trump is already high over his recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Here is Hanan Asharawi, a member of the Palestine Liberation Organization.
I would say that Palestinian rights are not for sale. There are imperatives and requirements for peace. And unilaterally, President Trump has destroyed them. He has even sabotaged our efforts at achieving a just peace and getting freedom and dignity for the Palestinian people. By recognizing occupied Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, he has totally destroyed the very foundations of peace.
This news comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany. About 40,000 African refugees, many from Eritrea and Sudan, could be deported from Israel under a plan approved today by the cabinet. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said under the new plan, asylum applications will only be granted in rare cases. The government is offering $3,500 to those who voluntarily leave the country before the end of March. Now to the West African country of Equatorial Guinea, where the government has announced that it thwarted an attempted coup against President Teodoro Obiang Nguema late last month. The coup attempt was allegedly staged by mercenaries recruited by the president's political opponents. And finally, North Korea has reopened a key cross-border communication channel with South Korea for the first time in nearly 2 years. The two rivals are exploring the possibility of sitting down and talking after months of acrimony and fear of war. For more news and information, visit our website dw.com or our Facebook page DW Africa. My name is Jane Nyinge.
This is DW's Africa Link with yet another exciting program. I'm Jane Ayeko-Kumet.
With me, Isaac Mugabe, and we'd like to welcome our followers on Facebook. Keep commenting on the stories we're going to present right now. We begin today's program in Nigeria, where Boko Haram leader Bakar Shekau has released a video message claiming a series of attacks in northeast Nigeria during the festive season.
Yes, the shadow leader released his first video message in months amid a surge in violence, casting doubt on the Nigerian government's claim that the jihadist group is defeated. For more on this story, Muhammad Alamin sent us this report, now presented by Fred Muvunyi.
Abubakar Baba is a political analyst from northern Nigeria. He says the problem is within the system.
People should do justice to this government because it is not the fault of the present administration. Insecurity and many other vices we are facing. Already the system is in the verge of collapsing.
So disturbing indeed. That is exactly what Isiaku Musa, a resident in Maiduguri, Borno State, expressed as he shared his feelings.
We are tired with what is going on in this region. Government and the military are always saying they defeated Boko Haram, but this is far from the truth. Boko Haram are still attacking innocent people. Now their leader, Abubakar Shekau, appears in a new video claiming responsibility for such attacks, and the government is mute about it. It's better for them to come out and tell us the true situation. But Boko Haram is not defeated.
And Abubakar Abdullahi, also a citizen of Maiduguri, has a message for the military.
The military has to do a thorough reorganization of their military officers so that there is no part X among them who used to sell the arms and ammunition to the oppositions who are fighting them back. That is why the war against terror in Nigeria does not come to an end, particularly the Boko Haram issue, because there are some saboteurs among the military officers who are sabotaging them for their own personal benefit.
Those familiar with Boko Haram messages confirm that the man that appeared in the video is indeed Abubakar Shekau, the top leader of Boko Haram.
And that report was filed by Muhammad Alamin in Nigeria.
And Jen Kofi Mike says, yeah, 1 billion has been allocated to fight Boko Haram. What a shame. And we asked on our Facebook page, do you think Boko Haram has been beaten like the president alleged in his New Year message? And you've been sending your comments. Jen, let's read
certainly,
some of them.
Certainly, yeah. They've been quite a mixture of them, those who do agree and those who do not agree. For instance, Alagoa says, a defeated army does not continue to successfully execute suicide attacks. These announcements are being made to reassure Nigerians and win their confidence. But many Nigerians are aware of the situation and it will take more than the announcement or the statements to persuade them.
Usman Mohamed Gashua says, at least we now live peacefully compared to the last regime, during which bombings and shootings of innocent persons went unchecked.
But another one who says, of course, there is a bit of peace there, and that is Farouk El Naftai, who says, Borno State is my home. We thank the president and the military for their effort in eliminating Boko Haram. Borno State is peaceful now. Keep those comments coming, and we shall read them as and when we can. But first, we go elsewhere in the world, and it's North Korea that has reopened a suspended communications line with South Korea in what may be a sign of swelling tensions. Now, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un ordered that the hotline at the country's border be reconnected.
The two Koreas have been making overtures to improving ties since New Year. So what's behind the surprise announcement to reopen this line of communication? And to answer that question, DW Sarah Kelly spoke to Hannes Mosler from the School of East Asian Studies at Berlin's Free University. Take a listen.
It's symbolically very important to reconnect this landline that had been the only connection between the two countries until it was cut under the rightist conservative governments of South Korea. But what is mostly important here is that it was not surprising at all that North Korea came forward at this point of time, because even the foreign policy of North Korea needs the direct dialogue and the direct connection. It's for their strategy to be implemented. It's like fire that only burns with oxygen.
So is it fair to say then that it's a diplomatic breakthrough, a potential de-escalation, or is it just another phase in the conflict?
Well, that depends on how you define breakthrough. But I would say these talks, if they take place, would be already very successful if they only talk about, for example, the athletes to be sent to the south, or maybe family reunion, and maybe other corporations in the humanitarian sector. And I would also discourage both parties here not to press, to demand too quickly for the big issues on the table.
Hannes Mosler from the School of East Asian Studies at Berlin's Free University.
And now we come back to Africa. Now, from presidency of a Nobel Peace Prize winner to that of a former football star, George Weah, Liberians are not only happy to have a peaceful transition of power, but are also full of hope and expectations.
Liberia has experienced slow economic activity since the Ebola outbreak in 2014 and 2015. Revamping the economy and expanding the employment base are some of Weah's biggest challenges. Evelyn Pade reports from Monrovia.
Across the country, even the smallest child has got an expectation of what they want to see a George Weah government address, from building national unity to creating jobs. I caught up with some Liberians outside the capital, Monrovia.
His success will depend on all of us Liberians galvanizing our efforts, our expertise to make this work, because Liberia is not about George Weah.
I want George Weah government to build more vocational schools for the Liberian people and young people, because most of our young people are not in school, they don't have skills.
I want George to get the Liberian people together, especially with the crown in the queue. I want you to start thinking something about what can I do with peace. One of the places I want for George to work is, especially with the food, let Liberian try to feed himself. Tobo said it, Do said it.
And it's not only expectations. Others also fear the many challenges that await the new president and his team.
George Weah's challenge ahead of him will be people that are not creative in society, who will try to infiltrate through friendship or other means to depreciate his government.
We need roads.
We need roads. When there are roads all over the country, a common man can plant his potatoes and bring it to the city and sell to make good money. Your children can go to school. But where there are no roads, it's going to be very hard.
Alan Sile is a lecturer of economics at the University of Liberia, summed it all in an economic perspective.
Liberia's issue on economics is actually not individual problem. Economics is actually dealing with production, but the productivities in Liberia have become very low. Everybody wants to buy from the market, and you will realize that the market price will increase. Cash is not coming in, you are not producing anything, you are not exporting, you're only importing. What I think we can put in place for our economic situation is to maximize production, prioritize rural, because when there is rural, you can invest in agriculture.
That report was sent in by Evelyn Pade in Monrovia.
Now, Jen, people are commenting on the story on Nigeria about corruption and how the money has not, you know, been used to tackle the Boko Haram. But in a related development about corruption, yeah, Zambia's Foreign Affairs Minister Harry Kalaba resigned because of the path the country has taken of insatiable greed and shame, which he said is unacceptable. And Jen, in his words, he said, "There comes a time in a person's life when it becomes necessary to die to self for the good of others. And if not for that reason, at least to stand for one's cherished ideals and values." We posted this on our Facebook page, mm-hmm. and so many people comment about it.
Yes, it's also an inspiration and a good thing to see that there are still these kind of leaders in the continent.
And he's a foreign affairs minister.
Yeah, it gives us hope that not all the leaders are
bad. Let's read some comments, yeah.
Of course, Obachani Peter Bugu from Obolo in Nigeria says, of course, it's the right decision. He's shown that he cares for the people he serves.
Looks like he has so much support. Mark from Zambia says, yes, it's a right decision. The current Zambian government is struggling with massive corruption allegations.
As well as Malikana, also from Zambia, who says, yes, it was a right decision. He has proven to the country that he is a just and selfless man who loves his country.
And Trevor Kanyanga Mshala says, a minister of foreign affairs has taken an exemplary personal step in an advance against the many unfortunate corrupt acts he has obviously observed.
Interesting. Another one coming from Barton Sekuambwe says, most of our politicians in Zambia are difficult to be judged because we don't know what is in his mind. Tomorrow, we may hear that he has formed a political party or joining an already formed party. What would be the morality behind his resignation? That's also a question to think about.
Keep the comments flowing on our Facebook page, DW Africa.
And you're still tuned to DW's Africa Link program. My name is Jane Ayeko Kemet.
And I'm Isaac Mugabe. In the next 15 minutes, we'll be hearing how insects have been added to the menu for families in Kenya.
There are a lot of people, particularly children, who are extremely undernourished. And they are malnourished because they don't have adequate food. And yet we have a lot of insects in the lake region.
Insects in the menu, Isaac.
Exactly. Grasshoppers, white ants in Uganda. And remember, the UN has also advised people to eat insects because of their nutritious
value. In other words, in the region, we've been ahead of this before the UN came up with the nutritious value that is found in insects. East Africans, we're already ahead of that. Anyhow, tune in for... Don't go away. That story will be coming in shortly. But first, we go to South Africa, where taps could soon run dry in Cape Town, one of South Africa's most popular cities. Now, lack of rains in the Cape Town province has left the city's dams heavily depleted and the remaining water is now expected to only last until March this year.
And as Tuzo Kumar reports, Cape Town, South Africa's affluent city, has now imposed strict water rationing with usage only limited to essentials.
While the city of Cape Town is only a stone throw away from both the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean, it is experiencing the worst drought ever to hit South Africa in decades. Authorities have warned that the city's day zero water could be as early as 18 March 2018. This has forced the city to tighten water restrictions in all areas, including domestic, industrial and agriculture sector. Councillor Xanthia Limbeck, the city's mayoral committee member for corporate services, says residents have no choice but to comply with the new measures.
Well, we did the public naming and shaming, where we identify the top 20,000 users and we release the names of the top 100 users. But going forward, we'll continue with our enforcement activities, the issuing of fines and notices to appear in court to sustain our water supply going forward.
These measures have taken a toll on the entire population of the city, as explained by Lucy Mazwi, a mother of one and a resident of Cape Town.
The flushing of toilets, whatever water I use with the washing machine, I use it for flushing. And I wash my dishes like in the morning and keep that water so I can wash the dishes again in the afternoon, just trying to save a little bit of water. And the kids, they used to go for swimming lessons and stuff. It's not happening anymore.
Terry Winstanley, head of environment law practice at Cliff Decker of Mayor, says the city is quickly running out of options and a scientific solution is needed fast.
From what I understand, the prognosis long term is that the city can expect to receive less rainfall than it has historically. A possible other solution would be mobile desalination plants, which could address a short-term need.
However, the city has already drafted a plan. Once day zero kicks in, 200,000 water points will be stationed across the city. Each resident will be given 25 liters of water per day. While others point to the drought and climate change phenomenon, others say the city has accommodated too many people than its water system can carry.
Tuzo Kumalo reporting.
On the spot.
Now, landlocked Mali seems an unlikely place for industry. But building factories is exactly what a few Malian captains of industry want.
That comes on the fact that Mali imports most of its consumer goods from all over the world, while it could be making its own at home. Two questions then. Why does Mali keep importing all these goods? And is there really a market for stuff made in Mali? Bram Posthumous reports from Bamako.
In the 1960s and 70s, Mali's factories turned out a good range of consumer goods. They were all run by the state, a sign of the times. The country was newly independent, and the then Soviet Union, with its elaborate five-year plans, served as an example for many a new African state. Fast forward 40 years, and almost all of that activity is gone. First, the world's major donors, World Bank and International Monetary Fund, told the Malian state that it had no business being involved in industry. Privatization was the buzzword. Mali's factories were sold off. The result? One of the country's main industrialists paints a rather bleak picture. Here's Cyril Ashkar.
We don't talk about industry anymore. This is now a nation of traders. There was a lot of industry, but 80% of that has disappeared. The state needs to retake its responsibility in that respect, but it will take time.
That's one part of the equation. The World Bank and the IMF are re-examining their core beliefs, and the consensus now appears to be that, yes, there is a role for the state to play. But in the meantime, China has entered the scene, mass-producing goods and outpacing all competition. So, where can Mali excel? The answer? In developing agribusiness. That's what this government agency is doing. It's called Programme for Increased Agribusiness Competitiveness, and its technical director is Fatoumata Haidaraba.
We're
giving advice. We build infrastructure, better storage capacity for two of our main products, mangoes and maize. Our mangoes have a ready market in Europe. As for maize, we want to transform our surpluses into high-quality feed for better meat and milk.
And in getting this business off the ground, Madame Haidara's agency hopes to create 15,000 jobs. And creating jobs is a priority for Mali's re-emerging industry. Cyril Ashkar heads the organization that lobbies vigorously for Mali's industry. It has identified 23 production lines with a ready domestic market, almost all of them agriculture-based. Can it be done, in spite of the rather somber picture he painted earlier?
Oh yes, we are living proof that it can be done. There is a market. There is even an export market. It can be done, but you have to believe in it.
Il faut y croire.
Many issues need to be addressed. Unfair competition and illegal imports being one of industry's biggest headaches. A less oppressive tax regime would help. And then there's the lack of properly trained staff, poor infrastructure, banks that don't provide credit, and crucially, a very powerful lobby of the big traders. But Mali's industrialists will press on until this is heard all over the country once again.
Bram, posthumous with that report. 15,000 jobs, that's something good for the Malians, isn't it?
Exactly. It's high time, you know, they kind of, you know, put in place mechanisms, you know, to attract even investment, especially to create jobs for the youth.
It's a good way to start.
Mm-hmm.
Living Planet Africa.
Now, protein-rich insects are being billed as a key to food security amid global population growth. But some countries are already ahead of the game.
Yes, absolutely, Isaac. You're very right. Now, Ugandans have been eating insects since time immemorial, and Kenyans consider flying ants a delicacy. As Linda Staude found out, one professor is researching on how to blend bugs into biscuits and sausages. Her report is now presented by Sarah Stefan.
Eunice Omolo grabs a large grey plastic box from a pile of boxes. Gently, she takes off the lid. Inside, the box is lined with egg cartons that neatly divide the box into small chambers. In each of these separate chambers are crickets, lots of them. One box could contain up to 1,500 crickets, even as many as 2,000. In her kitchen, Omolo easily has 60 of these boxes, all neatly stacked on top of each other. Why does she have that many bugs in her house? Omolo breeds crickets and then sells them.
I started it as a hobby, and now it is becoming a business. For consumption, somebody, I think I'm doing consumption.
Insects, Crickets, grasshoppers, termites are everywhere in Western Kenya, and these critters often end up on dinner plates. But until recently, catching insects was seen as child's play rather than serious business.
They would say that these things, we only picked them when we were little, because you would run around the farm, run around the gardens and pick one cricket or two crickets. You roast them on a naked fire out there in the garden and eat.
That's Monica Ayeko, a university professor in Bondo near Lake Victoria.
I started working on insects when I realized that there are a lot of people, particularly children, who are extremely undernourished. And they are malnourished because they don't have adequate food. And yet we have a lot of insects in the lake region.
Catching crickets in the wild is a tedious process. It takes a long time and isn't very efficient. With her research, Ayeko has come up with the best methods for raising crickets and has taught her techniques to breeders. Grace Achieng is one of them.
It's not hard work. We feed them with cabbage, flour, and a mixture of other fodder. In nature, insects live on greens, so we give them that here as well.
Eating insects was still considered normal for her grandparents, but today's young people remain skeptical. Judith Thauma was one of the brave ones who actually ate a cricket to see what it tastes like.
I once tried a fried insect and it was good. My mother prepared them and I took only one. I removed the head and took a tiny bite and then quickly ate the whole thing because it was delicious.
Monica Ayeko says it's much easier to grind grilled crickets into a fine powder and use that as flour for cooking.
The idea now, how to bring in a processed food such that it doesn't look like a bug cricket that's going to bite somebody. That's when I started working on biscuits, because I know biscuits are a favorite of children.
Cakes, biscuits, and porridge made with insects are now available in local supermarkets, made by a company that buys the bugs from the breeders.
That interesting report by Linda Staude. Now, Isaac, you're from East Africa. Which is your favorite insect?
Well, growing up as a child, I tasted the grasshoppers. And of course, the flying ants, like they've been called in this story, but actually we call them white ants. I mean, we enjoyed, you know, getting a grub wherever they flow out of the anthills. And in that report, Jen, we heard of Professor Ayeko talking about growing up, also tasting the crickets. Your namesake, Ayeko. So, Ayeko, you yourself, did you do crickets and grasshoppers?
I just told you Uganda and Kenya were already ahead of this, and I'm Ugandan. Certainly, you know that I must have been running around chasing after the flies. Huh?
Okay, without beating around the bush, what did you prefer? The crickets?
I had no preference. I just had one choice. Until now, I will still run for the white ants.
No grasshoppers?
No grasshoppers. Okay. I'm yet to learn that one. But the white ants, don't make me salivate in the studio now, Isaac.
Okay, well said. Jen, the story we did about water shortages in Cape Town, right?
Yes.
And it reminds me of, you know, when you have to spare water more often. I mean, you know, to save water every time you open the tap. Think about the people in Cape Town, South Africa.
Certainly. We were trying to make a calculation. Now, if you have a family of four people and you go to the toilet and you have to flush with 25 litres of water, I don't know how sufficient that is.
Tell us what you think about these stories by visiting our Facebook page, DW Africa. And we posted also a story about Israel, which said it would pay thousands of African migrants living illegally in the country to leave, threatening them with jail if they were caught after the end of March. At least 38,000 African migrants live in Israel. So we asked you, what do you make of Israel Prime Minister's decision to expel African migrants? And we have
it's not just a bunch, but it's amazing how contradictory they are. There are those who are for these, and there are those who think it's a different move. For instance, Caleb here says, Israel is slowly becoming America's slave. Why deport or jail people who are running away from troubles?
Well, Carl Nicholas says, God bless Israel. Mm-hmm. The order is a measure aimed at checking illegal migration after most African nations voted against the people of God. I mean, that's his, you know, comment saying Israel.
Mm-hmm. And Egwe says, look, no country will keep unproductive people within its borders. I'm sure the skilled, educated, and ultimately productive immigrants will be kept.
Ayodele Bali says, under the circumstances, it's better for them to take the money and leave. The way things are going, Israel is not the safest place in the world right now.
And one quick last one here says, get them to Uganda and Rwanda once they receive their lump sum.
Many thanks to those who contribute this program by commenting on the stories we have for you. And on behalf of the rest of the team, I'm Isaac Mugabe.
And I'm Jane Ayeko Kumet.
Bye for now.
Bye.